This is Peter Helland with Dr. E. Michael Jones. We're looking at two movies today. The one that some people might recognize is called The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think that was 1954. And the new one just came out that is the remake, is called The Shape of Water. And we're going to look at those two movies. Mike has written an article titled Sex with Monsters. And the scripture, I think, that may parallel some of the themes here is 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14. It says, "And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness." So we're looking at some themes here, Nietzsche, transvaluation of values, this and that. But in a way, this is up your alley, in my mind, because your PhD, if I'm correct, was in Nathaniel Hawthorne, and you were trained to analyze literature. You were trained to look at, in this case, a movie, and try to get an understanding of what's happening, what's the message, how is that influencing the viewers.
Yeah, I thought, I read about it and went to see it before the Academy Awards. As soon as I saw it, I thought, this is going to win the Academy Award. I knew it was going to win because it's speaking to the situation right now. This is the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. It's the first Academy Award since the Harvey Weinstein scandal. Hollywood is in a state of crisis. They have to feel good about themselves. And so how do you feel good about yourself? Well, you make a movie about the underdog. And who is the underdog now? Well, the underdog is the monster. The monster is now the hero. So what you're doing here is, as you said, participating in the transvaluation of all values. In other words, this is the world turned upside down. This is the 1950s turned upside down. Whatever was good in the 1950s is now bad. Whatever was bad in the 1950s is now good. And what was bad was the monster. Obviously, the monster is ipso facto bad. And now the monster is not only the hero, it's the romantic lead. That's the way Guillermo del Toro described this monster.
The last one we talked about was X-Man, and the hero there became the homosexual. So now we're upgrading.
We're upgrading to bestiality, yes. We've left homosexuality behind. So, as I said in the review, which is in Culture Wars, the oligarchs don't think. They hire people to think for them. And so they hire people like Nietzsche and Foucault, especially Foucault, who was hired at Berkeley. He was hired to turn the world upside down. And we have movie producers like Bryan Singer, who did X-Men, and now Guillermo del Toro, to make this palatable or comprehensible to the population at large. So this is like Foucault for the masses. Okay, the transformation of the monster into the hero. That's what we're talking about here.
Now you conclude. Your conclusion is pretty powerful. And if I can jump right to it. Your last sentence here, second, is the main reason for this paralysis is the Hollywood film industry, which has convinced us in films like The Shape of Water, which is what we're discussing, to have sex with the monster instead of killing him. So we're being paralyzed by Hollywood's effect of convincing us. So Hollywood's having a tremendous impress.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the 50s. The 50s was, in many ways, the classic era of the horror movie. And so you had movies like The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is about the takeover of the United States by something we don't understand, which was happening at the time. It was basically, that was about social engineering, I think, because everybody knew things were changing, but nobody knew who was doing it. And the people, like Uncle Bill, looked the same, but he was completely different. It was maybe about communism. Maybe there were communists subverting the... Nobody knew. Nobody knew. You had Them, which was about giant ants, okay, in the sewers of Los Angeles, who were eating people. They're giant ants because they did an atomic bomb test in the desert, and the ants got turned into, you know. who knows what's going to happen now?
But when you saw that at age seven, the Creature of the Black Lagoon, what was the conditions of how you saw it? Did your parents take you to the film?
No. My parents never took me to movies. We just went to the movies. Everybody went to the movies on Saturday.
Right. Yes,
and go in, and that's what's playing. It was the neighborhood theater, or the NABE, as they called it in Hollywood.
Yeah, what we did, we went to where the community hall dances were, and everybody just sat on the floor Saturday. And then they'd have a break, and you go across to the grocery store and get your candy, and you come back. And the whole community, the kids, would be sitting on the floor.
Yeah, that's what you did. It was the Saturday picture show.
Yeah.
So it was kind of an American ritual, and Creatures from the Black Lagoon was playing at that time. So I did a book on this. It's called Monsters from the Id, which is basically about monsters, about horror movies. It's about Frankenstein, Dracula, and Alien.
Del Toro said his favorite was Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He loved Frankenstein, and the guy that did the costume for Shape of Waters for the monster had done a Frankenstein thing for Del Toro.
Yeah, yeah. He made a statue of Frankenstein for Del Toro. So there, I felt that there was a culmination of sorts here. By the end of the 50s, the genre sort of came to a conclusion. It runs in 10-year cycles. But with Forbidden Planet, which had Leslie Nielsen in a dramatic role, and the Forbidden Planet is about landing on this planet, and suddenly everything's out of control, and they're hiding. There's a monster out there, and they can't seem to stop it. So they're basically they're in this hideout, and it's Krell metal, which is 17 inches thick, and the monster's coming through the Krell metal. I mean, how is this possible? And then finally, Walter Pidgeon, who's there, he's the main character, the kind of the old guy, says, well, that's because it's Monsters from the Id, which is the title of my book. But I mean, basically what they're saying is that the Id, or those unconscious desires, those appetites you have, if you let those appetites get out of control, they will become monsters and they will devour you. Well, guess what was happening in the United States at this time? The appetites were getting out of control.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the sexual revolution was just starting up. It had already landed in places like Hollywood, which is in advance of every place else. But the sexual revolution was turning the sexual appetite into a monster. And that's precisely what no one could figure out, you know? That's what Hollywood was about. So the culmination of this was Alien in 1979. Now, we're talking about 20 years of time. 59 to 79. So the sexual revolution had already peaked. And it was, and now we're heading downhill into another cycle of horror movies, because we're now going to talk about the sexual revolution as it really was, which was monsters. We had created monsters. We had all suffered from the sexual revolution.
Yeah, but the producers of these movies, are they conscious? I mean, is this just happening? I mean, why are these movies coming out?
Well, I decided I'm going to talk to the people. So I actually interviewed Hans-Rudi Giger, the Swiss guy who created the monster in Alien, which dominated horror movies for 20 years. That monster was so powerful. And I went through his book of drawings, and there are all these pictures of dead babies. All kinds of weird stuff, kind of pornographic, but dead babies. So I got him on the phone. And I said, he was amazed that some American could speak German, so we spoke German. And I said, it sounds to me as if this is about abortion. Did you ever procure an abortion with one of your girlfriends?
That's pretty bold.
Yeah, why not? Why not? You only have the dime. It's my dime, so why not? So it turns out that all of this is about his girlfriend, Lee Tobler, and she committed suicide. So he said, no, I never procured an abortion, but we were determined that we were not going to have children. So number one, this means that basically the church fathers were right when they say contraception is every bit as vicious as murder and as abortion, and there's really no difference between them. But it leaves out of the picture, maybe you didn't, but maybe someone else did. Maybe I think what happened is that Lee had an abortion, didn't tell you, and then committed suicide. And you're left trying to figure it out. So Giger, this is the monster and alien. This is where the monster and alien came from. This is the guy who created it. And it was about the sexual, Alien was about the sexual revolution. And it was about how sex now can kill you. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. And so you had the famous, so the story of Alien is basically you land on this planet. You're always going to some other planet, which means you're going into the id. And the guy, William Hurt, walks in, and there's this kind of spaceship that actually looks like a woman spreading her legs, and he's kind of walking through the vagina. But you're looking around, and then suddenly something attaches to his face. And they drag him back, and suddenly the thing dies. And he seems to be okay. Whatever that thing was, it just kind of died, shriveled up and died. He seems to be okay. So they're sitting there eating, and suddenly he gets pains in his tummy, and then you have the famous alien scene where the monster explodes out of his stomach and starts running around the spaceship, and no one can seem to catch it. Well, this is sex now. This is sex after the sexual revolution. It'll kill you. It's dangerous. It's ugly. It's awful. It'll kill you. And nobody could admit it. And so people went in droves to the movies to see this depiction of sex because it resonated with their experience in a way the public discourse could not. Because if you asked everyone, anyone, they'd say, yeah, I believe in sexual liberation. Of course I do. What do you take me for, a freak? You think I'm a bigot? You know, but deep in their hearts, they know, well, geez, I got a venereal disease from that chick, or she broke my heart, or we had to have an abortion. And so there were all these ugly things associated with it. That's where it came from. That's where the monster was. That's the monster that Del Toro adopted. Because he saw, apparently he saw, he's younger than we are.
53.
So he saw it in Mexico when it was being retreaded. You know, they sent it down there because nobody's watching it here anymore. So he saw it about 10 years after it had come out. And it made a big impression on him. Because
well, what made a big impression? You said he was writing in his diaries, his sexual fantasy that he wanted to. Well, they all wanted to have sex with that.
Let's be honest here. It was a very sexual movie, especially for 1954, because you got this girl, you know, and she's the center of the whole thing. I mean, everybody's going after this girl, and there's kind of sexual tension and jealousy in this thing. But you have this is ballet, water ballet. This is the era of Sea Hunt. Remember those TV movies about underwater? You always had some type of underwater.
Bridges? What was his
Lloyd
name?
Bridges, the Lloyd father Bridges. Of all this, the other guys who became famous actors. He also had a starring role in Airplane. But anyway, Lloyd Bridges would put on a scuba tank, and they'd have underwater shots. And the culmination of that was one of the James Bond movies where they had all these battles underwater. So everybody's fascinated with being able to swim underwater, you know. So the Creature from the Black Lagoon comes out with lots of underwater shots. Well, it turns out there are these kind of ballet scenes where the woman, she's swimming, and right. Then the monster's swimming underneath her, you know? So it's kind of like this sexual fantasy here.
Well, just think about it. When you were a kid, you went to the swimming pool, didn't you? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right. And when you were at the swimming pool, girls were in the water, too.
That's right.
So what do you think most boys were doing?
I don't know. I'm not... have to tell me about that.
Well, they're looking at, you know...
looking at girls.
They're looking at girls they could never look at them.
I have to admit that I looked at lots of girls at that period of my life. But anyway, so here is this kind of fantasy where you've got the monster from the id. It's clearly some type of manifestation of sexual passion. And the white guys, because it's only white guys in the movie, have to subdue the monster. You know, now let's be honest here. This was a pretty wimpy movie, to be honest with you, because they didn't really kill the monster. They fired a spear gun at it, and then he got a spear stuck in him, and then he swam away back.
And then they shot the smoke out at him.
And something like they had some type of where they were going to paralyze him with something or other. So it never it's very inconclusive. You never really get to killing the monster, but that's the way it was then. Because I think what you're seeing in the 50s is its ambivalence towards sexual liberation. Sexual liberation is a monster. If it's a monster, you have to kill it. There's no question about it. But that's what you do to monsters.
But what about the connection in the beginning? It's opened up with a quote from Genesis. Okay, and then it starts out with this creation account, and then it merges, and then in your article you talk about Ernst Haeckel.
Yeah, so first of all, it's like classic Hollywood, which is like a mishmash of religion and science. So the beginning of it is, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Well, I agree with that. That's the first sentence in Genesis. And then before, about 2 minutes into that, suddenly we have footprints on the beach, and suddenly we're with Darwin. As if there's no contradiction between these two accounts. And then, but what you really say, the crucial figure in this regard is, as you mentioned, Haeckel, the German philosopher, biologist. And he's crucial because the monster in Creature from the Black Lagoon is Gill Man. That's what they call him. The monster in Shape of Water is Gill Man. Okay?
Gills.
He's got gills. So he's kind of like, why did he have gills? Well, Haeckel is famous for one sentence. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which means the development of the human being recapitulates the development of the species.
Especially in the embryo, the womb.
So when he's talking about the embryo, Haeckel had these, he didn't know what, he had drawings, he made drawings, which were completely inaccurate. And at a certain point there were, of development, it looked as if the fetus had gills. And so he said, well, it's obvious that you go through the stage of being a fish. It was pure evolution. But you were saying every human being went through the evolutionary process.
Right, and that was
in
huge,
the womb.
And it was huge at Notre Dame, because one of the most intellectual of Notre Dame's professors, vice president, was John Zahm, you know, Zahm Hall. And Zahm wrote a book, Evolution and Dogma, that was put on the Forbidden Index, okay? And then they had to talk to him privately. They didn't go public. But Notre Dame really never left its following of Zahm. So it's always been strong. Evolution.
Yeah. And not willing to explore the contradictions, which we have explored in the talk we did on the New Atheism and on Harari's book as well, full of contradictions. So, but Hollywood is there to cover over these contradictions. So it's Haeckel. Haeckel was eventually involved in a scandal because he basically cheated on his illustrations. In other words, what they're doing here is trying to make the evidence fit the theory, and the theory is Darwinism and evolution. So you're going to fudge the evidence simply to make the theory look right.
Right. And Del Toro started out Catholic, and then you noticed in his other films they'd have Catholic symbolism, like the rosary, and then every film would be less and less, and now by this one, there is no Catholicism.
Yeah. Yeah. Del Toro started out being very Catholic. So if you go to, he'd start out with a horror movie called Mimic. And Mimic is about bugs, giant bugs in the subway system in New York. So in many ways, it's a remake of Them, you know, which is about giant bugs in the sewer system in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So the bugs are attracted to human blood. So there's an entomologist, a lady entomologist played by Mira Sorvino, who was involved in the Harvey Weinstein scandal. But there's a child on the railroad track, on the subway track. The subway's heading toward them. The monster's about to eat the child. And Mira Sorvino, the entomologist, pulls out a rosary.
And the crucifix?
And there's a crucifix at the end of the rosary, a metal crucifix. And she takes the crucifix and jams it into the palm of her hand. And blood starts coming out. Well, this is obvious reference to Christ. You know, we're in Holy Week now, Christ's crucifixion, Christ shedding his blood for the salvation of mankind. Obvious reference to this. The monster sees the blood. The monster goes after Mira, leaves the child alone, and then gets hit by a subway train. So it's a very Catholic movie. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed. I thought, wow, this is really Catholic. Then he went on to do Hellboy. And Hellboy, at the beginning of Hellboy, there's the Nazis are on some island off of Scotland doing one of these weird occult experiments. And the American GIs show up, and they're ready to attack the Nazis. And a priest shows up, and he holds up his rosary. And he says to the lieutenant, you may need this. And, of course, the lieutenant's an American. I don't need that crap. Get out of my way. And they have the battle. But there he is still holding up the rosary. You know, he probably is the champion, the Hollywood champion for smuggling rosaries into movies.
But he started out, he was raised by a very, very strict, he says, Catholic grandmother.
Right.
And it's kind of like how Mexico went, you know, Mexico itself, you know, had strong Catholicism and then it had these communist moves, you know, and he's kind of
Yeah, it's a land of extremes. There's no middle ground in Mexico. Either you're, you know, you go to the beach on Lake Michigan and there's a Mexican guy with Our Lady of Guadalupe tattooed on his back. You know, this is real Mexican devotion. But it's also the home of Plutarco Calles, and it was a haven for every commie in the world during the 1920s, including Trotsky, mm-hmm. who showed up there. If you want that story, you can watch the movie on Diego Rivera and his girlfriend, the painter, whose name escapes me at this point. But anyway, that's what it was. So it's this land of extremes, and he's got this kind of folk Catholicism that is, I don't want to say anything bad about folk Catholicism, but it's local. And chances are, if you remove it from its locality, which is Mexico and Our Lady of Guadalupe, it may not thrive. And this is one of the chronic problems of immigration to America. People bring their culture with them, and it's transplanted in soil where it will not thrive. And I have to say, in defense of the triple melting pot, the Catholics did thrive in their way. And they did assimilate in their way, and they had a vibrant culture, but it could not survive as a Catholic culture. And so you have all these Catholic politicians and all of these Catholic justices on the Supreme Court, and they don't make a damn bit of difference about anything. It's still the great Satan, no matter how you look at it. Sodomy, usury, you know, that's what this country stands for. And the Catholics haven't done anything to stop that.
Well, their strategy of assimilation didn't work.
It didn't work. And Americanism does not work. And we could talk about that a long time. But Guillermo del Toro is an example of this. I hate to say it, but this is the most completely political correct movie to come out in a long time. It is like total political correctness. And I think you just mentioned that Del Toro just got divorced.
Yeah, that's what I read. That he
so
got
anyway, it looks as if he's gone over to the dark side. Complete capitulation to the great Satan. He's gone over to the dark side. And now he's making movies that they love. And guess what? They gave him an Academy Award for it. So it's not surprising here. It's not surprising. But we're talking about why we've all become monsters.
Well, he's I remember reading a quote. He said, he quotes this guy. He goes, I'm an atheist, thank God. Thank God I'm an atheist, you know. You know, like it's, you know, I broke through and now I see the, you know.
What do I mean here? There's a lady by the name of Professor Hendershot, who wrote a book called The Politics of Deviance. And she said, deviance is constant. There is always going to be something that is right and something that is wrong. You can't live in a world where there's no right and there's no wrong. They tell you that for a while until they get in power. And then when new people get in power, they impose their own views of right and wrong. So the main thing that got transformed during this period of time was the idea of sexuality. And what used to be right in the 1950s is now wrong, and what was wrong in the 1950s is now right. And the classic example would be sodomy. Of course, sodomy. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do, since we have abandoned real morality as a country, as a nation, and as a culture. Well, you can't abandon right and wrong. You have to have some sense of right and wrong. So now what happened is what Nietzsche said. You have the transvaluation of all values, and now you're saying that anything in the 50s that was good is now bad, and anything that was bad is now good. And that's the world we live in.
Well, you know,
it's the anti-50s.
You know, Freud, you know, the scripture says mortify. Mortify the deeds that are put to death in the first four it lists are sexual. So, you know, so the Christian was always, you know, that's one of the things you work on. You put the sexual impulses.
Well, the Greeks had similar views. They would just say, instead of putting it to death, which is kind of a Hebraism, which is kind of an exaggeration, they would say, well, you have to have put the passions under the control of reason.
Yeah.
You have to have reason in control.
And, but then with Freud and all that, they started...
Well, Freud accepted completely the Platonic notion of the soul. He called it, changed the names instead of reason, spirit, and appetite, or reason, will, and appetite. He called it superego, ego, and id. Mm-hmm. And that's where we got the term monsters from the id. And he didn't do it exactly. He felt that culture was dependent upon suppressing sexual desire. But his disciple did. I mean, Wilhelm Reich was his disciple, studied directly under Freud, and did exactly applied Marxism to Freudianism. And basically, that turns the world upside down. So now it's desire rules reason. Mm-hmm. And that's the world we live in.
Right, and so even in the seminaries and all that, they were saying, well, you gotta...
Now, when desire is... When you remove any type of rational restraint from desire, desire becomes a monster. The simplest example is the horse, which is the example that Plato used. Basically, the rider on the horse. If the rider is in control, everything's fine. If the horse is in control, then you're in trouble. And I've been in situations like this. As a kid, we used to ride horses, and these horses were so tired, they knew when they had enough, and they would turn around and head back to the stable, and you couldn't do anything to stop them because they were going home,
yeah.
You know? And so I'm on this horse, and this horse starts galloping toward the street. Well, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened because I was completely out of control, and yet I guess the horse was sensible enough not to gallop into traffic. But you see the type of danger that you're involved in.
We grew up on horses. You know, we had horses.
And, yeah.
And I mean, you do see the connections. I mean, you get on that horse, you got to let him know right away, you know, boom, I'm in charge.
I'm the boss.
Yeah, I'm the boss.
Yeah. This is also in Greek mythology in the story of Hippolytus with Euripides. Hippolytus is itself a kind of pun. Hippo meaning horse, and luo means to untie, or we have the word dissolve, something analysis from it, or to be undone, or to kill. So that's the paradox here. You can untie the horse, but if you do, you may be undone by the horse. And that's what happens to Hippolytus. He brags what a great horseman he is and how he can keep these under control. And then Phaedra tries to seduce him, and he resists. But she's so furious, she calls upon Neptune, and Neptune rises up out of the Poseidon, rises up out of the sea, and scares the horses, and he gets trampled to death by his own horses. So you can get trampled to death by your own horses, or you can be destroyed by your own passions, because the passions become a monster, and the monster will kill you. Let's face it, the monster is a monster.
But in the movie, you have this... Julie Adams, I mean, she's as gorgeous as it gets, right? And the two guys, she came with her boyfriend. You know, they're going to get married.
You're talking about Creature from the Black Lagoon now.
Right, right. And so it was all about an infatuation with her. I mean, everybody was infatuated with her. And obviously the spectator, Dotaro, saw that when he was getting. He was infatuated with her.
Yeah.
And you said he wrote in his diaries continually.
Yeah, he was just fascinated by her. So what you have is... The woman and the monster they're kind of the same thing. In other words, the woman is the representative of sexual desire or the object of sexual desire. If that sexual desire gets out of control, it becomes a monster. So that's, you see the relationship there between the monster and the woman.
But the movies were promoting this. The movies tended to, they conquered Del Toro. He couldn't get it out of his head, you know? And so those movies had an intent, in a sense, of conquering
it. It became more explicit as time went on. Hollywood was determined to break the production code. They broke it in 65 with The Pawnbroker when they put bare breasts on the screen. That's how. So they were heading in that direction.
But Hollywood's working with the people watching it. The people watching kind of want them to break it.
Well, so what? Yeah, this is news to you? That people have sexual passions that they like to gratify, and oftentimes in ways that are not rational. Of course, this is the weakness that people have. This is why we have things, concept called original sin, because we have difficulty controlling these passions. Okay, and so you got a group of people, namely the Jews who run Hollywood, who are determined to exploit these passions for financial gain, but then the smarter of them are familiar with Wilhelm Reich, and they know it can be a form of political control as well. And that's why they are useful to the oligarchs, who use sexual liberation as a form of political control.
But your constant theme was that the monster has to be killed before you can lay a hold of logos.
Well, that's so. All right, so let's take it back. Take it back to classic examples, because this is not the first monster story. In a sense, civilization began with a monster story. And I'm talking about Gilgamesh, which is the first piece of writing, the first story that ever got written. It's older than Homer, which comes
we had to read
second.
Him at Notre Dame.
Yeah, yes. And it's basically it's on all of these, it's in Akkadian. It's written on all of these clay tablets, and it was basically the mythic foundation of Babylonian Mesopotamian culture. And the story is that a kind of a fantastic story. You can see that myth is the beginning of logos, you know, but myth is pretty much things I don't understand. So Gilgamesh is the hero, and he has to go off on his adventures. And one of the adventures he has is to slay the sacred bull, or the bull of heaven. Well, what is the bull of heaven? What is the bull? Well, it's this pagan, maternal fertility cult that was rampant in the Middle East at this time. The Hebrews called it Baal or Astarte. Astarte, and what was the representation of this? It was half bull and half man. And so I have the image in the review, the printed copy. There's this picture of the seated bull. The bull is seated. It's got the body of a man, the bull's head. It's seated there, and in its hands it is holding a child, an infant. Well, this is because child sacrifice was part of this religion. So you had temple prostitution. It's a fertility cult because the bull is a symbol of fertility. You know, powerful fertility. You admire this power. You'd like to have this power of your own, you know, as your own. And in order to get it, you're willing to sacrifice your own children. And so we have that same type of culture here with abortion, where we have our fertility cult, where we have our own version of human sacrifice, and we call it abortion. So it fits in with that. Now, this will impede. This fertility cult will impede any advance in civilization. You will be locked into some type of horror story for the entire, all of your entire civilization will be locked into this horror story. So how did civilization begin? Well, civilization began when Gilgamesh killed the bull. Mm-hmm. That's why he's the ruler. And it wasn't just in Mesopotamia. The same thing happened with Greece, except we're talking here about Crete. We're talking about the palace in Knossos, and the palace in Knossos has a labyrinth. Del Toro did a movie called Pan's Labyrinth. And the labyrinth, at the heart of the labyrinth, there's a creature that is half man and half bull called the Minotaur. The Minotaur is the result of bestiality.
Because the Poseidon,
Pasiphae hid inside a statue of a cow and had sex with Zeus, who took on the form of a bull. And the offspring of this bestiality is the Minotaur. And the Minotaur demands human sacrifice. And at this point, Greece, Hellas, whatever you want to call it, the Achaeans, the Mycenaeans, are a colony of the Minoans, and the Minoans exact tribute, and the tribute is every 3 years you have to hand over 9 young people who will be sacrificed to the Minotaur. Well, Theseus is a Greek boy who thinks this is unjust, and he goes and he slays the Minotaur, he kills the monster, and this is the beginning of Greek culture. This is the rise of Greece.
So it is the David and Goliath.
It's more, I would say it's more like Moses and the golden calf. But basically, it's a monster. in order for your culture to proceed, in other words, in order for Greece to achieve its independence from this Minoan tyranny based on human sacrifice, you have to kill the monster.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the parallel would be they had to tear down the Astaroth poles, you know, the prophets.
Right.
Which represented fertility goddesses. I mean, it was yeah. this female sexual thing.
Right. It was temple prostitution. That's in the absence of any real type of spirituality, the closest thing to spirituality and transcendence people come to is sexual intercourse. Gives you that sense of cosmic feeling. Okay, and that was exploited by these people. And in order for civilization to proceed, he had to kill the monster. He had to slay the bull, and that's why Gilgamesh was the hero, and that's why Theseus was, in many ways, the founder of Greece. Because he killed the monster and liberated those people from the hegemony of the monster god, which demanded child sacrifice. Now, we're all living way beyond that. And what you're seeing here is a return to the very thing that Theseus killed and Gilgamesh killed. In other words, a return to the worship of the monster, child sacrifice, Moloch, whatever you want to call it. And Del Toro is leading the charge. He's leading us all back into bondage to the monster by portraying the monster as the romantic Gilman as the romantic lead in this movie.
Well, I mean, to broaden it, World War II, the god of the soldiers, on a practical basis, was sex. Okay? I mean, that's how we were raised. I mean, that was their collective god. It was sexual interest and pursuit to kind of help those soldiers together.
Wars always have a corrupting effect on morals. There's no way wars and prostitution go hand in hand. There's never been a war without prostitution. And the Second World War was no exception to that rule.
But some wars, you know, like, let's say, with Cromwell, they had a strong religious, you know, and in the South.
Their religion was the religion of Moloch. Cromwell was a Judaizer. He was a return. He repudiated Jesus Christ and worshipped the Old Testament God. Who was the devil? He worshipped the devil.
But these wars have gotten worse, put it that way.
Well, there was a certain time where war was basically some dudes out there fighting each other. If you look at the war, the next great advance in civilization would be Homer's Iliad, which is this description of war between the Trojans and the Achaeans, which took place before the plains of Ilium, and that was just guys fighting guys. That's all it was. Of course, when one side won, they would go in and rape and pillage, and they'd steal all the women, you know, and take them back with them, you know. And Herodotus said this was basically the cause of the war between Greece and Persians. It was basically abducting women. You know, one side would abduct a woman back and forth, and that's what led to the war. But no matter how you look at it, I mean, the wars were more limited in scope than they are now. And now the change took place during the American Civil War, where the North waged a kind of genocidal campaign against the civilian population of the South, which is what Sherman's March to the Sea was. And the culmination of this was World War II, where the target of the German, both the American and the English Air Force, was the cities, to destroy the cities, German cities. They had the culmination was Dresden, had no military value whatsoever. Why did they firebomb Dresden? Well, to terrorize the German population. And that became the war goal for the British Empire, terrorize the natives by killing a lot of them. And the Americans took it over in World War II.
Right, so it's less and less Christian. And then it's going the other way.
So that brings us to the setting of this movie is the Cold War. And you have Americans involved in the Cold War. And, of course, there are the Russians, who are also white guys, and they're involved in the Cold War. And they're both trying to steal Gilman. because they need him to dissect them so they can figure out how they can do
breathe
weird.
In outer space.
Yeah, breathe in outer space. Some weird, typical Hollywood sci-fi stuff. So the Russians are involved in this thing, and there's a Cold War. And the Russians are portrayed as villains, which also fits into our current situation right now. In case you didn't notice it, the Russians are bad people. They murder diplomats with poison in England and stuff like this, and we need to do something about the Russians. We are on the brink of war once again. And so part of the feeling that you have as a spectator in this whole thing is that, yeah, I do kind of sympathize with Gil Mann and the underdog, because we all hate the American Empire.
Because the whole world does. That's kind of
the whole world does, you know. And Hollywood is notorious for hating America, you know, because they're Jews and they hate every host country they ever live in. So there's a kind of resonance here, you know. We sort of do feel sympathy because the American Empire has become a monster all on its own. I mean, just to update things. Yesterday there was an article about the congressional hearings. And the congressional hearings were on Putin's State of the Union speech, in which he said that the Russians now have missiles that can hit any part of the United States.
More so than they ever could.
More so. It's like something new.
Yeah.
So the congressman said, is this true? Gee, this is important. So they call on the military. They call on the military experts who testify before Congress, and the military guy sits there, the general sits there and says, well, yes, as a matter of fact, it's true. In other words, we are completely defenseless at this moment in time. The Russians could obliterate any city they want in the United States of America.
But they always could.
But he said, we can strike back after they do it. So they can obliterate New York City, but we'll take out Minsk. We'll show them. Well, this is kind of a small consolation here at this point for the people who've just gone up in smoke in nuclear conflagration. So this is the era that we're living in. We're demonizing Russia, okay? Trump just appointed one of the worst warmongers on the planet, namely John Bolton, as his security advisor, a man who thinks still defends the Iraq war, even though Trump got elected by denouncing it, you know? So we're on the verge, so we're living in a world that seems like completely out of control. So naturally, we're going to sympathize with anybody who stands up to this this monstrous regime.
Yeah, but I mean, but we have a mayor in our town that could be the answer, because he's gonna run for president and save the day.
We can announce it here. The mayor, our gay mayor, is going to run for president. It's official. This is the man who got elected with 8% of the vote in South Bend, Indiana, okay? He's a man who failed to get the job as the chair of the Democratic National Committee. He couldn't get elected dog catcher in Kokomo because he's toxic in any other part, but he's going to become president. And what is the show here? This is the last gasp of the oligarchs. This is a man who has been anointed by the oligarchs, and this is the last gasp of oligarch power. Because according to the oligarchs, he's the perfect candidate. He's a homosexual. He's young. He likes bicycles. He's going to be the next president, and he's got nowhere else to go. He's all dressed up here in South Bend, and he's got no place to go. And so David Axelrod is going to make him president. Anyway, so what you're seeing here
is... He's going to slay the monster for us.
No, he is the monster.
Yeah, but that's what your whole theme is. It just keeps...
So what we have here is, why do we identify with the monster? It comes down to what I said about deviance. We have abandoned, we as a culture have abandoned sexual morality. It is official now. It is the official ideology of the United States of America that homosexuality is something good, even though every generation before us condemned it as something bad. Okay, now once you do that, you have, once you act on this, you're filled with all kinds of bad feelings, like guilt and everything else. And so you can't tolerate those bad feelings because you want to think of yourself as a good person. So how do you think of yourself as a good person? Well, you create a pseudo-morality or an alternative morality, in which case is, well, I may have had an abortion. I may have killed my child, but I don't eat meat, and I don't wear fur. And so, therefore, I'm a good person. And so what you have is an alternative morality that is basically rising up, the alternative morality of political correctness, rising up based on the guilt-ridden consciences of the people who have abandoned real morality, especially real sexual morality.
And of course, the scripture says, without holiness, you cannot see the Lord. Okay, and the Lord meaning Logos. I mean, Logos, you know, Jesus is the Logos. So without holiness, you can't get the Logos. But a true holiness, not a holiness that says I don't eat meat and I don't wear fur.
Yeah.
It's got to be an actual holiness.
So our mayor is positioning himself as the candidate for those people, you know. And so they're going, like, we had this children's crusade just this past week about guns and so on and so forth. All these people are going to be mobilized to basically buy the oligarchs for the oligarch candidate in some type of last gasp attempt to reimpose this discredited oligarchic rule back on the people of the United States of America. Because what is the candidacy of, what does Pete's candidacy mean? He's got the perfect resume. Which means the oligarchs have certified him as a guy who is capable of ruling over us. Okay. Now, he couldn't say the first time he ran for mayor, he did not let anyone know that he was a homosexual. Mm-mm. So he got elected under false pretenses. And then the second time around, he arranged his announcement, his coming out announcement, to coincide with the Obergefell decision, legitimizing gay marriage. Were you there at the press conference that I held with the black ministers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So you remember the reporter said to me, how does it feel to be on the wrong side of history?
Yeah, you had a good answer.
And I said, well, if there's ever an institution that's on the wrong side of history, it's the Supreme Court of the United States of America has been consistently on the wrong side of history. And then I said, did you ever hear of the Dred Scott decision? And of course, this guy had never heard of it, and all the black ministers burst out laughing.
Because that's their identity.
Because that's their identity. Of course it was. And if there's one thing that Dred Scott proves, it was that the Supreme Court was wrong. So if they were wrong then, you mean to say they're not wrong now? They're infallible? It's like they're the Pope or something like that? No. What we're having here is an uprising, and the Trump, no matter what you say, Trump is a phenomenon all by himself. But no matter what you say about Trump, the candidate, Trump, the president, Trump, the candidate, was a protest. And the people were protesting against this imposition of political correctness and are tired of being told that they should have sex with monsters, which is the whole moral of this Shape of Water movie. And so Hollywood hasn't changed at all. They're still promoting the same type of perverted sexual morality because they know that's a form of control. And that's what they're really being paid for. That's why they are the official propaganda ministry of the United States of America.
Well, it's like they're past the stage of reforming themselves. I mean, is there any hope of Hollywood?
I think I've lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it seems to me worse now than it was. I mean, more threatening now than it was back then. Just the threat of absolute nuclear holocaust. But at least then you thought, well, I had some confidence in John F. Kennedy, you know, that he was a grown-up and a rational guy. He was trying to make peace with Khrushchev. He was trying to end the Cold War, which is what ended up getting him killed, because the CIA thought he was a traitor because he did that. But at least I had some confidence in the guy. I don't have confidence in anybody anymore. Who, John Bolton? John Bolton, are you kidding me? John Bolton has now got the hands on the lever. John Bolton makes Dr. Strangelove look kind of like Gandhi by comparison.
So who is the monster here? You say America lacks, the main difference between Minos and America is that America lacks a Theseus who can penetrate the labyrinth and slay the monster. Who is the monster here? Is it the government? Is it the oligarchs? Is it, you know, I could say, is it Christian Zionism? We lack somebody that can slay the monster.
The monster is at root, it's sexual passion ruling over reason.
So we don't have the, so the church has been conquered to a degree.
So to any institution that promotes the notion that sexual passion should overturn reason is the monster. Or let's put it this way, it's what was the Minotaur? He was the symbol of Crete. He was the symbol of Minoan culture, and Minoan culture was based on child sacrifice. So that's what the monster is.
And it can only go so far, and then it stopped, you said.
Well, I mean, it will take it to its logical conclusion, which will be the total destruction of culture and the total enslavement of people.
But you have to get to the root. What has caused so much concupiscence or sexual desire to overtake America? I mean, where is it not just coming from Hollywood?
I just went through this. I just did a piece on Archbishop Chaput. Archbishop Chaput wrote Strangers in a Strange Land. He gave a lecture before First Things. And he said, over the past 20 years, we've had a shocking transformation in our culture. The people now who are just representing what were common sense moral views of 20 years ago are now being demonized as homophobes. And then he said, how did this happen? And then he says, well, I read a book by a man named Christian Smith, and he said, basically, during this period of time, secularizing activists took over our culture. Secularizing activists? What do you mean? Have you ever met a secularizing activist? Can you look them up in the phone book? Do they live in Indiana or do they live in Michigan? You know, what are you talking about? Well, this is a euphemism. Well, what's it a euphemism for?
Non-Christian Jewish radicals? I don't know. The Jewish radicals.
Basically, the Jew who subverted all the institutions of our culture, beginning with the Supreme Court, school prayer. Where do you want to begin? School prayer. Beginning in the 60s, there was this era of judicial activism that the Jews were heavily involved in. The AJC, the American Jewish Committee, was behind the school prayer decision, Shemp versus Abington, which happened right near where I lived. Okay.
Well, you can name, like you mentioned before, they subverted psychiatry. And they got the condemnation of homosexuality reversed.
Removed. There's not one institution where they haven't. And so what is the problem here? Chaput is saying, well, now we have gay marriage. How are we going to fight against gay marriage? Well, they lost that battle. Why did they lose that battle? Because they cannot identify the enemy. And why can they not identify the enemy? Because they can't bring themselves to say the word Jew. Now, if you go to, now that sounds like I'm an anti-Semite every time I say this, but if you go to Tikkun magazine, which is a Jewish magazine, and you go to an article by Amy Dean says, it was Jews that gave us gay marriage. Thank God for Jews.
Because Joe Biden said the same thing.
And then she goes to names and names. Rabbi David Saperstein was a crusader for gay marriage. His wife is Ellen Weiss. She ran the newsroom at NPR. It was a Jewish project from beginning to end. This is what Amy Dean said. And here we have a poor Archbishop Chaput who can't identify who his opponent is in the culture wars. So they have something like the Manhattan Declaration. Do you remember the Manhattan Declaration?
Mm-hmm. It was like an
evangelical. Everybody came out and said, we think gay marriage is ridiculous. That was 2009. They just blew it away. Amy Dean mentioned the Manhattan Declaration. That was the brainchild of Robbie George of Princeton, who is the brain trust for the Catholic Church. Well, they got blown out of the water, and Amy Dean mentioned the Manhattan Declaration specifically.
That it didn't have any weight.
It didn't have any effect whatsoever. So the point here is, you're not going to have any effect until you identify who your opponent is in the culture wars. That's what Sun Tzu said in The Art of War. He said a long time ago, the Chinese philosopher.
But in a sense, it starts in the seminary where they have to be militantly pursuing holiness and controlling their sexual desires. But if they're being influenced to express their sexual desires in the name of some...
Well, that was also what happened in the seminary. That was a black op, too. And the net result was the pedophile crisis.
Right, so you don't
go into these people and say, act on your sexual... As a matter of fact, Eric Erickson, Eugene Kennedy, did a survey that was commissioned by the U.S. bishops, and he applied Eric Erickson's theory of sexual maturity, seven stages of maturity, and if you don't have sex with someone, you're not a mature person. Well, tell that to a celibate priest, and guess what happens? They start acting out on their sexual impulses, and when you act out on your sexual impulses outside of reason, that becomes a monster, and that monster destroys you.
And you become enslaved to it.
You become a slave to that monster, which was the state of all of these Middle Eastern cultures until Gilgamesh came along, or until Theseus came along and killed the bull, or until Moses came along and broke the golden calf, which was a bull. Remember? It's what's what you're worshiping. They were worshiping the bull.
Well, the training used to go through, to become a leader in the church, you had to kind of go through strict boot camp of, like, say, a monastery, proving that you had control over your sexual passions, maybe primarily.
Yeah.
So because without that, you can't get a hold of logos. You can't see Christ in a way.
No, lust darkens the mind. That's what Thomas Aquinas said. Right. It divides the will. Darkens the mind and divides the will.
So you have
feckless Catholic leaders like Notre Dame. How many times have they changed their position on contraception, funding contraception, within a six-month period? I don't even know what it is. Does anyone know what it is anymore? No, because they have a divided will, and I've already mentioned what the cause of the divided will is. Okay? So that is the problem here. That is the problem here. We can't say, okay, that's the monster. No, you're saying we should vote for the guy, but no, we're saying, wait a minute, no, it's a monster. And so there's this contest between the oligarchs who control the culture and the people who actually are part of the political process who actually vote for somebody. There's a conflict here.
Well, Del Toro himself has become a monster. Del Toro, they had a review of his book that was a well-known reviewer, just blasted it, and they're so mad at him. But by watching The Black Lagoon, The Creature of the Black Lagoon, when he was 7 or 8, he started fantasizing, and he didn't put it to death. He kept feeding it and feeding it until he produces this film. And this Kevin Swanson, he's a big Protestant homeschooler kind of guy, but, this is the end of civilization, his review of that.
There is a connection. I just told you that the beginning of civilization came about when Gilgamesh killed the Bull of Heaven. The beginning of Greek civilization came about when Theseus slew the Minotaur.
And now we're resurrecting it back, and is this the end?
The exact opposite. So maybe it is the end.
Yeah.
Nothing lasts forever.
Well, you said the world as we know it's the end as we know it.
The end of the world as we know it.
And this guy was...
Confirmation of that fact.
Yeah, they're putting him all over because he just said it real briefly, but it's got him so scared that you're saying this.
Yeah.
So... We got 1 minute left. You're still working on the book Logos?
Yes.
This was chapter?
Actually, the whole story of Gilgamesh is part of the chapter on Logos, because that was a great advance. That was the advance. In order for Logos to advance in Mesopotamia at this point, Gilgamesh had to slay the bull of heaven. Okay. It's no different. If it's a monster, you've got to kill it. Otherwise, the monster takes over and you become its slave.
Right.
Or he eats you alive.
Okay. Peter Helen with Dr. E. Michael Jones on The Show Israel.